Good evening. Good evening and welcome to tonight's program. One program note before we begin. On Sunday, June 24th at 9 p.m., we will be hosting here at B'nai Yeshurun Dr. Jeffrey Gurak. Dr. Gurak is a professor of Jewish history at Yeshiva University, and he will speak on American Jewry's historical and contemporary scorecard. It's an honor for me to introduce tonight's speaker, Rabbi David Forman. Rabbi Forman is an internationally renowned lecturer on biblical themes and the principal educator at Aleph Beta Academy. He has served as an adjunct professor at the Johns Hopkins University and as a lead writer and editor for Art Scrolls Talmud Translation Project. Rabbi Forman has also served as scholar for the Hofberger Foundation for Torah Study for 10 years. He's the author of The Beast That Crouches at the Door, a finalist for the 2007 National Jewish Book Award, as well as The Queen You Thought You Knew. I'd like to thank the Schwartz Family Charitable Foundation for sponsoring tonight's program. Our topic for tonight is Moshe and Tzipporah at the Inn, the Exodus's most mysterious story. So it's indeed an honor for me to introduce Rabbi Forman. If anybody needs a handout, we still have some.
Okay, it's a real delight to be here. I think the last time I was here, It's about 3 years ago I did the thing on Eshet Chayil upstairs. I was here about 4 years ago, did the thing down here on Eliyahu with I think Menachem Liebtag at the time. So it's great to be back. Just a quick sound check. Can you guys hear me? Does the sound level okay? Yeah, in the back? Yes? You're good? Excellent. Okay. It's a thrill to be here. What we're going to talk about tonight, strangely enough, also has to do with weddings and marriage, a topic which is on my mind. We're making a wedding for our oldest daughter in about a week from now, which is very exciting. It's very, very thrilled to enter the club. So I always hate going to weddings, but somehow it's different when it's your own, you know what I mean? Very different. So it's very exciting. And still got two girls we're looking to marry off, so have at it, folks. But it's very exciting to be able to make a wedding. Tonight I want to talk with you about a story which for many years I avoided talking about. I avoided talking about it because I just had nothing to say. It was such a difficult, strange story that there just didn't seem to be anything intelligent you could say about it, so it was better off ignored. And what I want to do with you tonight is try to tackle the story. And I want to suggest that not only is it a difficult story, but it's actually a key story. It's a linchpin story. The story I'm referring to is the strange story of Moshe and Tzipora at the inn. It's a story which is odd, a story where right after the burning bush, where things seem to be going okay between Moses and God, all of a sudden God shows up at an inn and tries to kill Moses. If you never learned about it at school, if you're looking at me like I'm crazy, it's probably because they skipped in school because they didn't want you to be bothered by it. So better off kind of ignore the story. But it's there, and we're going to try to tackle it tonight. The reason why I think it's a linchpin story, and not just something which we encounter in passing, is because if you really think about it, the story part of the book of Exodus, of Sefer Shemot, right, it's all about, as the name Exodus suggests, it's about the Exodus. But if you think about it, it's not really all about the Exodus. There, you know, if you were writing about the Exodus, which is a great national story of deliverance, you might choose not to include the personal story, which is the story of Moshe as a person, right? We get this whole sort of Moshe origin story at the very beginning of the Exodus, how he grew up, how he's found in the little boat by the side of the river. And one great question is, why is that story there? If the whole point is to tell me the story about the Exodus, is that just for human interest so that we should understand who our leader was? Does it make a difference? How is it that we understand that Moshe origin story? Why is it so important? But the interesting thing is, if you think about where that story ends, this Moshe origin story sort of ends at that story of Moshe and Tzipora at the end. If you think about what the Moshe origin story really is, it's, you know, he's born, he's in the reeds, he's found by the daughter of Pharaoh, he hangs around the palace for a while, he grows up, he kills this Egyptian, he runs away, he goes to Midian, he marries, he sees the burning bush, he leaves the burning bush, he's on his way back home, he's on his way back to Egypt, and then all of a sudden, there's that story of Moshe and Tzipora in the inn, and from then on, it's the Exodus, right? So if that's the last episode, this story of Moshe and Tzipora in the inn, in the Moshe origin story, that would seem to suggest that it's the climax of the Moshe origin story, which means it's a pretty important story. It's a pretty important episode. It tells you something profound about Moshe, about what the Torah wants to tell us about Moshe. So what is it that the Torah wants to tell us about Moshe? And what is going on in that story? So what I'd like to do with you, the game plan here tonight, is we're going to do three things. There's going to be part one, part two, and part three. Part one is I want to look with you at the story that is the epilogue to the burning bush. In other words, the larger Moshe and Tzipora at the inn story. I want to look with you about the events right before that and kind of do a close reading of the text leading up to Moshe and Tzipora at the inn, starting from the end of the burning bush up until that encounter at the inn. That's part one, the epilogue to the burning bush. That's the way you can think about it. Part two is I want to go back into the Moshe origin story with the insights that we glean from the epilogue. And part three I'll tell you about part three in a second. And so the way to think about this, just in your mind, is you can think about the burning bush, the burning bush episode with Moses, and you can think of the burning bush as sort of having a prologue and an epilogue. The prologue to the burning bush is the first part of the Moshe origin story, which is the story of Moshe's birth and how he runs away to Midian and how he meets his wife. That's the prologue to the burning bush. Then you can think about the burning bush story, right? And then you can think about the epilogue to the burning bush, which are the events that happen after the burning bush leading up to that moment of Moshe and Tzipora at the end. So think about it in three stages: prologue, burning bush, epilogue, right? That's how you want to think about this. So stage one, we're going to look at the epilogue. We're going to start from the end. Stage two, we're going to look at the prologue. And stage three, we're going to look at both of them. What do I mean by both of them? That's where your handouts come in. In the handouts which you have, or if you don't have that handout, you can kind of look on with somebody who does, you'll find the prologue and the epilogue reproduced, with the burning bush represented as just the two, three words in English, the burning bush in the middle. Prologue and epilogue. But you'll notice that I've color-coded the text. So there are all these colors in the text. But if you look carefully, you're going to notice a pattern in those colors. What's the pattern? It's a chiastic pattern. It's an atbash pattern. Now, for those of you who've been around the block with me, you have some idea what a chiastic pattern is, or an atbash pattern is. For those of you who don't, basically, an atbash pattern or a chiastic pattern is a pattern where you can conceive of the first and last elements almost as an aleph and a tav. The first letter of the alphabet mirroring the last letter of the alphabet. Bash, bet and shin. The second element is second to first element is going to mirror the second to last element. Third to first is going to mirror third to last. It's a way of creating a text, a literary construction, and the academics call it a chiasm, where there is this sort of successive arrow-like focus of the text all leading you towards the center. What I want to suggest is that the prologue and the epilogue to the burning bush actually form a chiasm. They are it's an elegantly constructed piece of text that's a perfect mirror. Which is to say, the events that occur before the burning bush are a perfect mirror of the events that occur after the burning bush. Why do we care? Why is it not just a curiosity of biblical text? Why should you care about a chiasm like that? You should care for one very profound reason. If someone would ask you, someone would come to you on Shabbos afternoon or something and say, "So I'm looking for some good reading on Chumash, right? And I'm looking for a nice new Mefarish, you know, of any good commentary that I could read on this week's Parsha." So you say to him, "Well, what have you been through?" So he says, "Well, you know, I've been through the Ramban, I've devoted a year to that, been up, did the Sforno, devoted a year to that, did the Hamak Dover, the Malbim, did Hirsch, I'm looking for something new, right? Or actually something old, something very profound and old. You know, what do you think the most profound, oldest commentary of the Torah really is?" Well, what if the answer to that was that the oldest commentary of the Torah, on the Torah, before Rashi, before Unklus, before the Medrash, before the rabbis and the Medrash, before Sadia Gaon, before all of that, was the Torah itself? What if the Torah is its own commentary? So you say, how could the Torah be its own commentary? Well, it could be its own commentary. Imagine a chiastic pattern, right? Imagine a pattern where you actually had a text where there was this elegant mirror image in the text. Why would the Torah do something like that? You see, there's all these pairs, and the pairs pair off with each other. If the pairs pair off with each other, that means something, right? In other words, any given piece of text, right? If I think about 24 elements of text, and I look at the eighth element in the prologue, if that really has a mirror image in the eighth element in the epilogue, right, then it's almost as if the epilogue is going to comment on the prologue. You're going to learn something about, right? There's a commentary embedded here, right? It's not something you want to pass over. So the third and final thing we're going to do tonight is I want to show you a chiastic structure in these patterns, and I believe the chiasm is going to explain to us the meaning of the story of Moshe and Tzipora at the end. Okay, so that's kind of the game plan over here. But in order to understand what's happening in the chiasm, we need to take a look at the epilogue and the prologue in and of themselves, and then we'll come and look at the structure that I'm talking about. Okay, that's the game plan. Let's dive in. We're going to start from the very end of the burning bush and look at the epilogue. Here is the last and final episode in the burning bush. We're going to start from the final exchange between God and Moshe. And let me just, by the way, we're not going to spend that much time on the burning bush, but let me just, for a moment, just ask a fundamental question about the burning bush to you. There's really two sides to this question. There's a Moses side to the question, and there's a God side to the question. Let's start with the Moses side of the question. Right? So if I can have a volunteer here for just a moment, kind of a volunteer. No, everyone's scared. Mr. Fetterbush in the back of the room there. No, you're not going to be a volunteer. You're going to stay right over there, right? All right, Dan?
David.
All right, so David's going to be my volunteer, my reluctant volunteer. Moses was a reluctant volunteer too, right? So here's the thing. So imagine, David, you're driving back, and you're driving back with your wife. Your wife's name is?
Karen.
So David and Karen, driving back from this talk, and they're heading back to their home, right? And it's late, you know, because I ran late or whatever, and, you know, just want to get home. But alongside, they're on the side of the highway, Route 4 or whatever it is there, you know, Queen Anne Road. And then David spies this dumpster fire. Okay, there's a dumpster fire, right? And David's like, oh, man, a dumpster fire. Could we pull over and take a look? And Karen is like, can we just get home, right? And David's like, no, that's a really neat dumpster fire. And David pulls over. And he's just looking at the dumpster fire, and Karen's just like tapping her fingers, like, when are we going to get going? And David's like, there's something going on with this dumpster. And Karen's like, what? And after 10 minutes, David is transfixed, and he says, the garbage is on fire, but I don't think the garbage is burning. Right? Something's going on. There's a miracle happening here. And just as David says this, an angel jumps out of the dumpster and says, David, David, right? And David says, Hineni, here I am, right? And at that point, the Lord himself begins speaking to you, David. And if I stopped you right now and I said, David, you know, think about your next 5 years, you know, what's your plan for life? You say, well, you know, I have a job, I have a wife, I have a kid, I have things to do, bills to pay, right? Stuff like that. But imagine that the Lord came and said he had different plans for you. And the different plans, Lord says, David, America is facing a crucial crossroads. And there is a vacancy. There's going to be a vacancy and a retirement in the United States Congress for your district. And I need you to run for Congress. And register and run in the November elections. Just to prove I'm serious, the Lord says, you're going to wake up and there's going to be this check underneath your pillow drawn on the bank of God, you know, for $305,000 to start your campaign. And lo and behold, you go home and there's this check underneath your pillow. It's drawn on the bank of God for $305,000. You deposit the check and it clears, so you know it's really the Lord. You know what I mean? Okay, so there's no question. This is God who's talking to you, David. So the question I have for you, David, is if you knew this was God, because the check cleared, and God said, I know you have other plans, but you need to run for this congressional seat, what would you do? What's that? You'd ask your wife. All right, so Karen and David together, you're sitting in the car, you're looking at that dumpster fire, you know that this is God, right? Would you say, no, I have bills to pay, I have things to do, people to see, stuff at my job tomorrow, can't be bothered? Or would you like, no, you'd deposit the check, you'd run for Congress?
You'd run,
right? Most of us would run for Congress, right? So the question is, why doesn't Moshe? Moshe says no in that situation. He just says no. And then he keeps on saying no over and over and over again. As a matter of fact, the whole conversation between Moshe and God at the burning bush is nothing but no. Is God five times trying to convince Moshe. And there's one excuse after another excuse after another excuse. It's like, no, Pharaoh's not going to take me seriously. No, the people won't know your name. No, I can't really go. I don't have any signs. What would I say? I have a lisp. Right? One thing after another. So one question is, why does Moshe keep on saying no? Now, the other flip side of the question is, if you're God, right? If you're God,
why don't you give up?
like a lot of fish in the sea. Once he says no, like once, twice, one is like, okay, this evidently isn't working out. I'm the master of the universe. There's other, right? I can find somebody else. So why does God put up with this? God put up with this chutzpah of this guy who's literally talking to the master of the universe, and the only thing he can say is no. And God is like, okay, I'll try it this way, I'll try it that way. He just like doesn't give up. How come God doesn't move on? So it's the same question, but you can ask it from God's perspective on Moshe's perspective. Why is Moshe saying no? And why doesn't God just give up? So I want to just say two things for starter about those questions. I don't want to really answer those questions now, but I want to give you a framework for thinking about an answer to those questions. Let's start with God. If God doesn't move on after the first or second declination of Moshe, but keeps at it, what does that tell you? What does that force you into saying? Must be what? It must be that God can't move on. It must be that if God has decided that he needs a human partner for the Exodus to happen, Moshe is the only candidate possible, right? It has to be that way, because if there's another candidate, just find another candidate. This one obviously doesn't want the job. It's almost like there's this job description, and you have to qualify for the job interview, and the only guy that walks through the door with the qualifications is Moshe. And it's just not going to work any other way. And the question is, why? What's so special about Moshe? So that's one question we want to ask. Evidently, Moshe must be pretty special for God to put up with all these no's. Who is Moshe and why is he special? The second thing I want to say about the Moshe side of the question, which is why Moshe keeps on saying no, just sort of takes me back to you and your kids. Imagine it was you and your kid, not God and Moshe. And imagine you had something that you really wanted your kid to do, clean their room. And your kid comes back to you and it's like, no. But it's no like five times, five different excuses. No, I can't clean my room because of X. And I can't clean my room because of Y. And I can't clean my room because I just don't know where to put things. I can't, right? And you keep on going with this. And that's five different times, no, I can't clean my room for a different reason. Let me ask you something. Is the real reason why they don't want to clean their room one of those five things they told you? No. They just don't want to clean their room, right? There's a more basic reason that they don't want to, that you're not having a conversation about, right? So here's the question. What's the real reason why Moshe doesn't want to go? Was it one of those five excuses, or were they just five excuses? And if they were just five excuses, why really doesn't he want to go? These are the two questions I want to start with. Number one, why doesn't Moshe want to go? Why really doesn't he want to go? What's he not saying about why he doesn't want to go? And from God's perspective, and so why is Moshe the only qualified person? Why is he the only one who can do this? And I want to suggest to you a ridiculous theory, which is that these two questions that I just asked you actually answer each other. Which is to say, the reason why Moshe really doesn't want to go is the reason why he's the only possible candidate for this job. What's that reason? Now we're going to read the text and try to discover it. Let's start from the end. The end of Moshe's fifth and final excuse. The last thing Moshe had said to God was, I can't do it because I have a lisp, because I don't speak well. Okay, we're about to hear God's response to that. As I read God's response, I want you to, in your mind, grade God's response on a scale from 0 to 10, with 0 being, that's a pretty lame response, right? To 10 being, oh my gosh, that's an incredible response. Like, there's no way you could say anything to that, okay? So Moshe's position, can't go because I have a lisp, can't speak well. Here comes God with his retort. Vayomer Hashem Elav. So God says to him, Nisam Pela Adam. Who are you talking to? Who gave mouths to people? O mi asum ilaim, o cheresh, o pikeach, o iver. Who made people with disabilities? Who made people deaf or dumb and unable to do things? Who made mouths? Halo Anochi Hashem. Am I not the creator, the maker of all? And if I say that you can do this, you can do it? That's God's response. All right, on a scale from 0 to 10, how good of a response do you think that is? That's about a 10. That's a pretty good response, right? What are you going to say? You're talking to God. If God made mouths, he think you can do it. It doesn't matter if you think you have a lisp. Okay. You go and I'll be with you, God says. Listen to Moshe's response to this. Vayomer bi Adonai, my master, shlach na biad tishlach. Could you just find someone else? Now this response is qualitatively different than any previous response Moshe had made. Moshe had given five excuses until this point. How is this one response different than all previous five? No excuse. No reason. I'm not telling you why I can't do it. I'm just saying I can't do it. Just find somebody else. No more excuses, right? At that point, Vayicharaf Hashem b'Moshe, God became angry, because it's like one thing to say no if you have a reason to say no, but you don't even have any reasons and you're still saying no. So here's what God says. Now, before we even read what God says, let's just stop for a moment and play one of my favorite games. What should happen next? If you were the writer of the Bible, or if you were God, what would you say to Moshe? You've worn him down, right? Gave you five responses, five excuses, not even excuses anymore. It's just, look, can you find somebody else? Just find somebody else. And you're God, and you really think that, no, I need you, okay? There is nobody else. So what would you say to Moshe? What would you say to Moshe? Forget what it says here. What would you say to Moshe if you were God? If you were God, you might say this is time for an executive decision, right? It's time to stop quibbling with the kid as to whether he wants to go to bed. Do you know what I mean? Upstairs, now. Do you know what I mean? It's like, I'm sorry, there's no argument anymore. You're going. I'm the master of the universe. You're going. Something like that. Yeah. Right, but God's answer evidently is, I don't have anybody else, right? Which would be a perfectly fine thing to say. Look, I very nice of you to be submissive and try to get someone else. I don't have anybody else. You're elected. This case is closed. But listen to what God in fact says. Halo Aaron Achicha Halevi, God says. I have an idea, Moshe. What about Aaron? Aaron, your brother, the Levi, Yadati ki daber yidaber hu, I know that he would speak, v'gam hinehu yotzei likratecha. And anyway, he's coming out to greet you now. V'racha v'samach b'libo, he's going to see you. He's going to be so happy in his heart to see you. V'dibarte elav, you should talk to him, v'samtas advarim b'fiv, you should give him the words, and I will be with his mouth and with your mouth, and I'll teach you both what to do. What's strange about God reverting to this? What's strange about what God just said? If you could pick apart this verse for just, oh, that's odd. I wouldn't have expected God to say that. Why would you not have expected God to say this? Yeah?
Because in the beginning he said that I'm God. Don't worry about your lisp. You can do this.
Exactly. So you understand? Go back to what we just said. The issue of a lisp, the issue of Moshe being unable to speak, right? Who won that debate? God or Moshe? God won that. We agreed, right? He won. He had a 10. He just shut Moshe down. I'm God. You got to go. So we've dispatched that excuse already. So if you were God, if Moshe already is not using that excuse, he's falling back on, could he just find somewhere else? Then why are you relitigating the lisp? You won that point already, if you're God. Why are you saying, if that wasn't it, if that was just the fifth excuse, and it's just like, and now you're coming back to, oh, I have an idea, Aaron could go, and Aaron could talk, but you already won. You already beat the thing with a lisp. So why? Okay, so is he reassuring him? It sounds like he is. That's the Racha v'samach b'libo thing. But he's going to see you. He's going to be so happy in his heart, right? But by the way, I have news for you. Well, I'll keep that news for just a moment, right? But let me ask you one other thing. There's something strange about this verse. I'm going to read it again in slow motion. Tell me what's strange. There's an extra word over here. Vayichar af Hashem b'Moshe. And God became angry with Moshe and said, Halo Aaron achicha halevi, yadati ki daber yidaber hu. Aaron, your brother, the Levite, I know that he would speak. What word could have been cut out safely without any problem? Halevi, right? You needed that? What if the verse didn't have that? What if the verse just said, Halo Aaron achicha, but there's Aaron, your brother. Hello, yeah, right? I know that he could speak for you. Would you have come to me after this talk and said, Rabbi Foreman, I don't understand. It said in this verse, Aaron, your brother, could go speak, but wasn't Aaron a Levite? He was, right? So how come it didn't mention that he was a Levite? You wouldn't say that's like a spectacular question, right? It's like because it wasn't relevant, right? So why is it here? How come it says Aaron the Levite? And if he wasn't a Levite, Moshe's also a Levite. Who cares about him being a Levite? He's your brother. Why am I bringing that in? What's that there for? All right, so it's a strange thing. Let's keep on going. So then God says, you know what? Don't forget the staff. Take the staff. It can do all sorts of great tricks when you go to Pharaoh. Okay. So, what happens next? Moshe goes to Yitro. Moshe goes to Yitro and says, Elchana v'ashuv el achai asher b'mitzrayim. I'd like to go and I'd like to return to my brothers who are in Egypt, v'era ha'odam chayim, to see if they're still really alive, because they've gone through terrible suffering. What's he doing? He's an employee of Yitro, right? So he's asking for a leave of absence. I'd like to go check on the folks back in Egypt. And Yitro, like a good employer, says, Lech l'shalom, go, take as long as you need. It's on me, right? We'll see you when you come back. We'll have a job waiting for you as a shepherd. Okay. Now, what would you expect to happen next? There's been this long discussion between God and Moshe, right? God finally got Moshe to go, evidently. Then Moshe says, asks for a leave of absence from his employer. Employer grants it, so the next thing that should happen is... He should go. Yes. Look at the next verse. Vayom Hashem Moshe b'Midyan leich shuv Mitzrayim. God says to Moshe in Midian, go return to Egypt. What do you mean go return to Egypt? I thought he's on his way. But like he's still not on his way. It still took God to like nudge him out the door. Anyway, so Moshe takes his wife and his children. And if we just have to stop here, and I would say, okay, how do you think God and Moshe are doing? Last thing that God said to Moshe, right? When you go to Mitzrayim, remember all your magic tricks. You've got a staff that could do all sorts of neat things. You could throw it down on the ground. It could turn into a snake. You can turn water into blood. You could do all those things. Remember those things. Do them before Pharaoh. And don't get discouraged if Pharaoh says, no, it's just me, God. I'm hardening his heart. I know he's not going to set the people free. If that happens, you just tell Pharaoh, Ko amar Hashem, thus says God, B'ni b'chori Yisrael, my firstborn nation is Israel, and I'm telling you, Shalach et b'ni v'yavdeni, send forth my people and let them serve me. V'tma'en l'shalcho, and you, Pharaoh, you dare to not let them go? You do that, I'm telling you in the end, Hine anochi hareges b'ncha b'chorecha. I'm going to kill your firstborn son. That's what you should tell Pharaoh. Okay, so you take your staff, Moshe, you do all these great tricks. This is God signing out, see you, have a good trip to Egypt, right? And God just kind of winks out. So how do you think, if you're a psychologist, how do you think God and Moshe are doing now? How's their relationship? Scale from 0 to 10. 0, it's terrible. 10, they're doing really great. How would you say God and Moshe are doing now? No, anybody? 2, really terrible? They're doing pretty good. Moshe's going, right? Took a while. God is like, you know, take your staff. Don't forget your staff. You know, that reminds me of, it's like, you know, when you're a kid and you're going to school on the first day and your mother calls, don't forget your lunchbox. It's really great. That Star Wars lunchbox. It's really wonderful. Right? Don't forget your staff. It could do all these neat things. It's cute. It's loving. It's beautiful. It's like an 8. It's a 9. They're doing really well, which makes what happens next so strange. Vayipa derech b'malon, that night at the hotel, vayifkasheyu Hashem, God meets up with Moshe, vayivakesh hamito, and tries to kill him. What was that about? What? You just said, don't forget your lunchbox. What do you mean he tries to kill him? How do you even read those words, right? That's the problem. How do you even read that? And God tries to kill him at the hotel. And Tzipora seems to know exactly what to do. She figures it out. Oh, it's that Mila thing. We forgot to circumcise our kids. So she takes this rock, performs emergency surgery. And she says, you're a bridegroom of blood to me. There's the marriage theme I was talking about before. And then God leaves Moshe alone. And she says, you're a bridegroom of blood to me through this circumcision. Okay, so that's it, and the next thing that happens, Vayomer Hashem el Aaron lech likrat Moshe Amidbara. Right? So the question is, what's going on with that hotel thing? So a clue comes from this very next verse. What's strange about this next verse? Vayomer Hashem el Aaron. So God says to Aaron, lech likrat Moshe Amidbara, go greet Moses in the desert. Vayelech, and he goes, vayifkasheu bar Elokim vayishaklo, and he greets him in the mountain of God, and he kisses him. Verse 27, read it again. What doesn't fit? Something is strange about this. God then says to Aaron, go out to greet Moses in the desert, and he encounters him at the mountain of God and kisses him. Okay, so he's meeting him along the way, and he's meeting him, let's say, at the foothills of Sinai. All right, that sort of works, right? Yeah?
He said that he was on his way.
There you go. Let's get the chronology straight. This is the next day, right? Because it's after that night at the hotel, right? So let's say this is Tuesday, right? And the previous day was Monday, okay? So if on Tuesday God's saying to Aaron, could you go out to greet Moshe? What did God say to Moshe about Aaron on Monday? Didn't he say, and Aaron is already on the way to greet you? Well, was he on the way or wasn't he on the way? Doesn't sound like he was on the way. Because on Tuesday, God has to like say to Aaron, hey, Aaron, I think you should go greet Moshe, right? Go, can you do me a favor? Could you go greet Moshe, right? So it's like, so he wasn't on the way, which means, and I'm going to say something a little bit heretical here, so... it sounds somewhat heretical. It sounds like, just in push-up shot, because like, I kid you not, let's just go back to what God said before, just so you understand. Here's that earlier verse. Halo Aaron Achicha HaLevi, Aaron your brother the Levite, Yadati Ki Daber Yidaber Hu, I know he will speak, this is Monday. V'gam Hine Hu Yotzei Likratecha, and he is coming out to greet you now, and he's going to see you and be happy in his heart. You're reading that, he's on his way. But he's not on his way, because on Tuesday, it takes God the next day saying, Moshe, you should really go out and greet Aaron. It sounds like, this is the heretical part, that on Monday, God wasn't being entirely truthful with Moshe. That's what it sounds like, right? It sounds like he bent the truth just a little bit. Aaron wasn't really on the way, but it sounds like it's important for Moshe to think that he's on the way. It sounds like a white lie. Now, that sounds terrible, right? Why would God make a white lie? But there's something strange about this. As a matter of fact, who do the sages say did stuff like this? There were like these two people that had to get together. And then someone comes and says, hey, you know, he's going to come and he's already coming to see you and he's going to be so happy when he sees you. But it's not really true. And then he goes to that person and says, you know, you really should go see him. It's going to be amazing if you go see him, right? But it's not really true. And these two people like end up seeing each other and they embrace, right? But it took this white lie to get them to go. Who do they say this about, Chazal? They say it about Aaron. And you wonder where they got it from. Maybe they got it from here. Because think about it. This is the first time we ever meet Aaron. You never know about Aaron before this. This is the first time you've ever met him. The very first time we meet Aaron, God seems to be bringing together these two people through these white lies that otherwise kind of wouldn't get together. And it's almost like Chazal are saying, Aaron took that... the way that he got introduced to Moshe, and that became his modus vivendi. That's what he did with people after this. He became the Ohev Shalom V'Rodev Shalom, which means that God was initially doing that. But isn't that strange? What's the Ohev Shalom and Rodev Shalom part? What's the issue here? Were they going to fight? What exactly was going on? So the key to this, I think, goes back to this verse and the language of the verse that we talked about before. Halo Aaron Achicha HaLevi. That word Levi, I think, is the key here. Let's ponder the meaning of that word. That word is a modifier. It modifies Achicha, your brother. And Achicha modifies Aaron. So, if you look at the train of modifiers, here's what the verse really means. Moshe, I want to introduce you to someone who can be of service here. His name is Aaron. Which Aaron? Aaron, your brother. Which brother? Your Levi brother. Now, what's strange about that? He doesn't have another brother, but it sounds like he does. He had another brother, just not a Levi brother. Who is his other brother? For this, you have to go back to the prologue. Go back to what we know about Moshe from the prologue and tell me who's his other brother. It turns out that the words immediately before the burning bush is actually the words that clue us in to this other brother. Aaron Sorkin, creator of The West Wing, has a master class which you can view on screenwriting. And in it, he talks about when you know that you have a story that could become a movie, right? When do you have a story that's not really a good story, and when do you have a story that you know is a good story, right? What's the difference between a good story and a not good story? He says, you know, if you want to make a movie about your cross-country trip to California where a lot of goofy things happen, he said, that may be very interesting. I'm interested in hearing about all your goofy things, but you don't have a movie. You don't actually have a story. That's not a story. A story has to have two elements. And those two elements are intention and obstacle. Intention is somebody has to want something really badly. Doesn't matter what they want, but they have to want something really badly. I want to get to Philadelphia because I have a job interview, right? I want the girl. There's something that you want really bad. But the obstacle is there's something standing in your way. All the trains have broken down and you don't have any money to rent a car, but you have to get to Philadelphia. Now you have the beginnings of a story. You have this intense intention, and you've got this obstacle. I want the girl, but she can't stand me, but this is the only girl for me. What do I do, right? Intention and obstacle. Think about the story of the burning bush, the story of Moshe's encounter with God in terms of intention and obstacle, and name what the intention is and what the obstacle is. What is the great intention at the heart of the story, right? Let's take a look at the beginning of the burning bush story for a moment. These are the words right before the burning bush. Vayhi bayamim harabim ahem, and it happened in those long days, vayamat melech Mitzrayim, that the king of Egypt died. And when they died, the Jews finally had some time off, and they sighed, and they screamed, and their screams went up to God. And God heard their cries, and God remembered his bris, his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and God saw the people, Vayeda Elohim, and he knew, he got it, he understood their suffering. And immediately, the burning bush, right? I need somebody to help me get the Jews out of Egypt, right? And God declares his attention immediately to Moshe, right? Anochi Elokei Avicha, I'm the God of your fathers. I've seen the suffering of my people in Egypt, right? And I have an intention. What's the intention? To take them out of their suffering and to bring them to the land. So the intention is this divine intention. I want to save these people. They're in pain. They're suffering. I feel their pain. I want to do something for them. I want to take them out. That's the divine intention. What's the obstacle? Is the obstacle really Pharaoh? Strangely, I would argue that the larger obstacle is Moshe. For some reason, God thinks that he needs somebody on the ground, and for some reason, the only person on the ground who's good enough is Moshe, but Moshe's not going to want to go. So now we get to our question, what's the obstacle? Why doesn't Moshe want to do it? Here's the theory I'd like to suggest to you. A story is good if it has a good intention and it has a good obstacle. It's even better if the intention and the obstacle are just two sides of the same coin. And I believe that's the case here. There's one event, a single event, that creates both the intention and the obstacle in this story. And the event is right here in the verses. The event is this. Vayhi bayamim harabim ahem. And it happened in those long days. Vayamat melech Mitzrayim. The king of Egypt died. That's it. That's the event that breaks the chain. For 400 years, there had been this thing waiting, right? These people are in Egypt. But now the floodgates open. The king of Egypt dies. And from the standpoint of the people of Israel, that gives them time to cry out to God. God hears those cries, empathizes with the people, and is ready to act. But there's a problem. And the problem, I believe, Moshe's problem, also comes from that one thing, the death of Pharaoh. Why? Because put yourself in Moshe's shoes and ask yourself, what's the big deal if Pharaoh dies now? If Pharaoh dies now, who takes over? Do you get it? Who takes over? Who's the next king? What's going to be Moshe's relationship to that next king? They were raised together in the palace. It's going to be that someone that Moshe, as Steven Spielberg would have argued, went chariot racing with, right? Way back in the day. There were a lot of things wrong with Prince of Egypt, but the one thing that Spielberg, I think, got right was this, right? Which is that with the death of the king of Egypt, the new person who's going to take over Egypt is going to be someone that Moshe grew up with in the palace, someone that he had a familial relationship with, a brother, a cousin, someone like that, a brother kind of person. So now along comes God, and God comes and says, I need you to take this people out of Egypt. But in order to take the people out of Egypt, who do I have to go up against? You've got to go up against your own brother. Now do you get why maybe he doesn't want to go? This, I think, is the key drama in the Moshe origin story. This is the intention and obstacle that makes the burning bush come to life. Everything else is an excuse. There's five different excuses why he doesn't want to go. None of that's real. What's real is something Moshe doesn't want to say, something that's too personal, right? And it only comes to the surface when... It comes to the surface at the very end when Moshe runs out of excuses. And when he runs out of excuses, he just says, could you please just find someone else? And at that point, God says, okay, so now we're getting somewhere. Now at least we don't have any of these fake excuses. Now could we talk about the real reason you don't want to go? Right? And God then goes to him and says, I think I have an idea for you. What's the idea? You know, you do have another brother. For all we know, Moshe and Aaron have never met each other yet. It seems like they never met each other yet. This is our first introduction to Aaron. If Moshe had heard about this other brother, hello, Aaron Achicha, there's your brother Aaron, the Levite brother that you have. Hello, Aaron Achicha Halevi, I know that he would speak to you. Speak to you is just an excuse. It's not about speaking. We got rid of that already. But it's a convenient excuse to bring Aaron into the picture. You know your problem, Moshe? You don't hang around with Aaron enough. If you hang around with Aaron a little more, what's God's plan? If you can make this connection to this one brother of yours, what might it help you do? Gain enough strength to turn your back on another person you saw as a brother. If you have to choose between brothers. Because he's going to see you. Varacha, v'samach b'libo. He's going to be so happy to see you. He's going to accept you. If you're Moshe, what's your fear? Your fear is, would Aaron even accept me? Right? Who am I, really? It's an identity crisis at the heart of Moshe's character, and I want to show it to you a minute in the prologue. And therefore, God is willing to bend the rules. I'll lie if I have to, right? It's like, Aaron, could you go see him already? But I'm telling you, Moshe, he's on his way. Trust me, he's really on his way. He's going to love you, right? And somehow that's enough to get Moshe to go. Yeah, really? Aaron's going to accept me? Okay, I'll go. Go back to the prologue. Let's look at the earlier story, the prologue. This still isn't your source sheets. Oh, it actually is in your source sheets, more or less, right? Moshe gets born. And we have a strange chazal. Vayitzav paro l'chol amo. In those days, Pharaoh, we're back in the prologue. In those days, Pharaoh commanded all of his nation and said, Kol haben hayulud hayora tashlichuhu. All children that are born, throw them in the river. All male babies, throw them in the river. Chazal were puzzled about something. They were puzzled about this word, kol. Kol haben hayulud hayora tashlichuhu. All. Why didn't should just said haben hayulud? Any children that are born. What's kol haben hayulud? So Rashi quotes an interpretation. Anyone remember what Chazal say here? Why kol haben hayulud? Anyone remember? Rashi says that what Pharaoh did that day was he declared something extraordinary. He said on this one day, on one particular day, all male children need to be thrown into the Nile. Not just Jewish children, Egyptians too. Why? And then Chazal tell a strange story. They tell a story in which Pharaoh's astrologers came to him with a prediction. And they said, Hayom, today, Nolad Moshian Shal Yisrael, we have a prophecy to tell you, and it's that the Savior of the Jewish people was born today. We know certain things about him. We know not just that he was born today, but we know that fate has decreed that his end will come through water. So what should you do? It's true, Moshe's end does come through water. He hits the rock. Instead of speaks to the rock, the water comes, but that's his end. So the sages of Egypt knew that too, Chazal say. And they said, we know that he was born today, and we know that his end will come through water. There's only one thing we don't know about him. We don't know whether he's an Egyptian or a Jew. And therefore, Pharaoh comes up with this decree, Kol haben hayulud layor tashlichu, all children, whether they're Gentile or whether they're Jewish, need to be thrown to the river today. Because that's the way I'm going to get him. That's the way I'm going to drown him. That's the way I'm going to kill him, because his end is going to come through water. Now let me ask you something. If the astrologers were so smart that they figured out the guy's birthday, and they were so smart that they knew that fate had decreed that he was going to find his end through water, how come they couldn't figure out whether he was an Egyptian or whether he was a Jew? What's the answer? The answer is because that was undetermined. That was fundamentally undetermined. The whole story of Moshe is that he was neither, was that it's a coin toss. Who is he? The fundamental question is, who is he? He's the man from nowhere or the man from everywhere. He's conceived to Yocheved. Yocheved hides him in the reeds. And along comes the daughter of Pharaoh, Lirchot al Yor, to wash by the river. Venarotel Holchot al Yad Yor. And her handmaids are walking along the river. And what you're going to find with Moshe is a fascinating thing, which is that the ambiguities concerning his birth, concerning who he is, haunt everyone. They haunt not just Moshe, they haunt everyone connected with him. They're going to haunt the daughter of Pharaoh. They're going to haunt the people that Moshe encounters. They're going to haunt Pharaoh. You see it first with the daughter of Pharaoh. The daughter of Pharaoh sees this child, sees this little boat, Betoch HaSuf. Vatishlach et amata vatikachea, and she sends her maidservant, and she takes it. Vatiftach vatireyo et hayeled, and she opens and she sees this child. Vinei nar boche, and she sees there's this little child crying. Vatachmol alav, and she has compassion on the crying child. Vatomer, and then she says, Mialde ha'ivrim zeh, it's a Jewish child. What just happened in that verse? Take it in slow motion. What happened? How did you feel when v'nei nar boche, she sees the child crying, v'tachmol alav, and has compassion on the child? What do you think at that moment? What? You think, what's going to happen? What's going to happen next? It's good, right? Good story. Excellent. Heroic woman. She has compassion, it's going to be okay. But listen to the next words. Vatomer, and then she says, Miyalde ha'ivrim zeh. What's going on when she says, it's a Jewish child? Who is she? This is Hitler's daughter. You understand? It's a Jewish child, that's not good news. Do you understand? She's in conflict right now. There's two parts to her, right? One part of her is, as a human being, I see another child crying. And as a human being, my heart goes out to that child. He's another human being in distress, so as a human being, I want to save him. But then there's another part of me. I'm not just a human being. I'm the daughter of Pharaoh. I'm a loyal Egyptian. And when that part of me kicks in and I say, Mialde ha'ivrim zeh, it's a Jewish child, that part of me says, and therefore I'm duty-bound to get rid of it. I'm duty-bound to kill that child. You think it's easy for Pharaoh to ask everybody to drown children? What kind of national example do I make if I save this child? As she's haunted by this. Enter Miriam. Vatomer achoto abat paro ha'elech v'karati lachisha me'neket mina ivriot. Can I find a nursemaid from the Hebrews for you? She can nurse that child for a while. What did Miriam just do? She gave her a third option. You don't have to make this decision now. You don't have to bring that child home now. I see that conflict. Could I help you out? Could I give that child to a Hebrew woman to nurse for you? I think maybe that's a solution. The daughter of Pharaoh jumps at it. Vatomer la bat paro lechi, go do it. But now, a subtle deception takes place. What is it? Vatelech ha'alma. So the girl goes, Vatikra et em hayelad, and she calls the mother of the child. What's the deception? What did Miriam tell Bat Paro? What was she going to do? I'm going to find some lady from the Hebrews to nurse this child. Who does she go and call? Who doesn't she tell? You understand the problem? She doesn't tell Bat Paro that it's the mother, right? And how do you know? Because when Bat Paro comes 2 years later to pick up the child to take her home, listen what she says. Or actually when she comes right then and says, take this child. Vatamala Bat Paro, Helichi et hayelad hazeh, take this child, vani keuli, and nurse him for me, vani eten et scharech, and I will pay your wage. What do you see from that proposal? That she doesn't know who she is. Because you would never tell a mother that I will pay your wage. So Miriam is keeping this convenient fact. Which means, put yourself in Yocheved's shoes now. You've got your child back, but you don't really have him back, right? Because you're going to have to give him up. But you have him for 2 years. Think how anguished you must be. I don't have him. I only have him for a few years, and then I have to give him up. And even while I have him, what's the one word I can never say to that child? My son. I can never divulge. He can never know that I'm his mother. I'm just the nursemaid. Because that wasn't part of the deal. Because Bat Paro doesn't know that. So if you think about it, here's Moshe who gets delivered to Bat Paro. And little 3-year-old, 4-year-old Moshe, who does he think mommy is? The only mommy he ever knows is Bat Paro. And he grows up in the palace, which leads us to a shocking realization. And it happened in those days, Vayigdal Moshe, that Moshe grew up, Vayetze El Echav, and he went out to his brothers, Vayar B'Sivlotam, and he saw their pain. What's going on? What's strange about this? How did he know? The only mother he ever knew was the daughter of Pharaoh. He's chariot racing in the palace, hanging out with all the princes of Egypt. That's his destiny. I'm a prince of Egypt like anyone else. But all of a sudden, he grows up, Vayetze El Echav. Who told him? How does he know? It says he knows. It doesn't say he knows. But it seems like it does. Vayar ish mitzri maka ish ivri me'echav. He sees an Egyptian person striking a Jewish person from his brothers. It sounds clear that he knows it's from his brothers. Who told him? There's only one possibility. It had to have been the daughter of Pharaoh. It's the only possibility. The only one who has a connection with him now is the daughter of Pharaoh. Which means what? It means that here this heroic woman is, and she brought this child up in the palace as great risk to life and limb. And the easiest thing for her to do is to keep his identity away from him. You never were anything else, right? You're just, right? Of course, I had a nursemaid. Everybody has a nursemaid in the palace, right? You came to the palace, you're a nice prince of Egypt, but no. She feels a need to tell him the truth. And at some point, and we don't know when, she had to have had a talk with him. Was it when he was 8? Was it when he was 12? Was it when he was 16? We don't know. But at some point, she has this talk with him. And the talk has to go something like this. I love you very much. You're the only mommy I ever have. This doesn't compromise my love for you, but you have to know something because it's the truth. You're not my biological child. I took you. I cared for you. I'll always be there for you. But you're actually one of them. And she points out to the slaves. And if you can imagine what that must have done to a baby Moshe. And one of the difficulties here is that when you think of Moshe, you think of Moshe Rabbeinu, right? And there is no Jew who's more Jew than Moshe Rabbeinu. But the Torah isn't talking about Moshe Rabbeinu now. The Torah is talking about how Moshe got to be Moshe Rabbeinu. And it's telling you a story of how Moshe got to be Moshe Rabbeinu. So imagine, here's this Moshe in the palace, before he's Moshe Rabbeinu. Just Moshe, who's going chariot racing with his brother, with his and life is just, I'm a regular prince of Egypt. And all of a sudden, your mother comes to you when you're 12, when you're 16, and tells you this. What do you think? What did you think of those slaves? What had all Egyptians been conditioned to think of those slaves, especially if you were in the palace? What were those slaves there for? They were there for us. They were there for our economy. They were just tools that we could exploit. They were the immigrants. They were the downtrodden, right? And we could exploit them, and we could destroy them. But now all of a sudden, these are my brothers. And in that pain and in that anguish, Moshe goes out and sees an Egyptian striking one of those brothers. And what does he do? Vayifen kovako. Moshe looks this way and that. Actually, look at the verse before this. Vayhi bayamim ha'em, vayigal Moshe, vayetze alecha, vayar b'siblotan, vayar ish mitzri make ish ivri me'echa. There's an extra word there in that verse. He sees an ish mitzri hitting an ish ivri. What word could you have taken out and everything would have been fine? Ish. Could have just said, vayar mitzri make ivri me'echa. We would have understood that. What's the ish? What it's suggesting again is that there's two ways of looking at this situation. There are two things of note about these people. The first thing of note about them is that they are both an ish. So one way of looking at this conflict is there's two human beings and there's an aggressor and there's a victim. That's one way to see it. But there's another way to see it, because it's not true that the only salient thing about these people is that they're an ish. They also have national identity. One's an ivri. And one's a mitzri. And that's another way of looking at the conflict. A mitzri is beating up an ivri. Now here's Moshe, who's just found out, right? And he goes out and he sees this atrocity. Vayifen kovako, and he looks this way and that way. Now look at this word carefully. Vayar, and he sees. Ki ein ish. There's that word. It's almost like there's a double entendre here. Because if you keep on reading in the verse, Vayar ki ein ish, after he sees that there's no ish, Vayachet ha-mitzri, what word is missing?
Ish.
Isn't that interesting? So what could Vayar ki ein ish mean? Do you see the double entendre? On one level, it's I see no one's looking, but there's another level. What do you mean by Yar Ki Ein Ish? And the next thing is, I see the Mitzri and there's no Ish there. It's as if he looks at the Mitzri and sees in the Mitzri no Ish. It's like he's sucking the Ish out of the Mitzri. As if he's saying, yeah, you know, there's two ways of thinking of this conflict. There's one human being and another human being. But if you think about what you need to do before you kill anybody, any act of killing, what do you do before you kill somebody? How do you kill somebody? You dehumanize them. You've got to view them as the other. That's what the Egyptians were doing the whole time when they're throwing our babies in the Nile. They dehumanized us, and I was once part of them, but I'm not anymore, and I see these are brothers, and that was wrong. And now what am I doing? I'm looking at this aggressor who's just again beating up and treating my people as if they're nothing, and darn it, I'm going to suck the ish out of him and kill him. And almost objectify him, almost as if I'm sucking the ish out of him, almost like this tribal act. These are my brothers. It's identification with his brothers. But then, the perfect storm, because on the second day, two of his brothers are fighting. So if the only reason I interceded is because there was a foreigner beating up my brother, what would I do if there were two brothers and there was an aggressor and there's a victim? If the only thing I care about is foreigners beating up brothers, I wouldn't get involved. But he does get involved. And at that point, the aggressor confronts him. And the aggressor says words that will be important later. Mi samcha le'ish sarva shofet aleinu? Who made you the sheriff around here? What makes you think that you can intercede? What standing do you have in this dispute? I understand yesterday, you were coming to the aid of an Ivri, of a Hebrew, one of your own, that was threatened by a foreigner. But there's no foreigner issue over here. It's just two Jews having a dispute between us. Maybe the courts would settle it, but you're not the court. Who made you the sheriff? Who made you the officer of the land? You're just some guy. Halargeni Atomer, you're going to kill me just like you killed the Mitzri? And Moshe becomes scared. And he says, Achein no dahadavar. It's known what happened. And then something happens. Vayishma paro et hadavar hazeh. Pharaoh heard this thing. But there's an ambiguity in that verse. Pharaoh heard which thing? Because two things happened, right? Now we always think, which thing did he hear? He heard the first thing. That he killed the Mitzri, because Pharaoh would get mad that he killed the Mitzri, right? Pharaoh wouldn't have any interest in an Ivri getting killed. He only care about a Mitzri getting killed. But the problem is, Vayishma Parot HaDabar HaZeh happens right after the second thing, which kind of sounds like it was the second thing he heard about. It was the last thing that happened he heard about. But the problem is, why would he care? But if you think about it, he sort of would care, because what was the aggressor saying? The aggressor actually had a good point. What standing do you have? You're not the court. You're not dragging me to court. You're the sheriff. You can't just come in here riding in on high noon and pretend that you can come and solve this dispute. You can't kill me. You have no standing. Now, who is Pharaoh? Pharaoh has standing. He's the king. What if he hears that there's this vigilante going out riding around killing people, even Jews, because he thinks that he's got the right way of looking at things? What interest would the king have in that situation? Well, the king is in charge of the executive system, in charge of the justice system. He would say vigilantism doesn't work, so there might be an interest in the king even seeing the second thing and saying, sorry. In any case, Pharaoh says, I'm not into this, and Pharaoh wants to kill him. Vayivakesh laharog et Moshe. And Pharaoh wants to come and kill Moshe. And Moshe runs away. And he runs away to Midian. And when he's in Midian, hold on for a second, let me take you through this thing and then I'll take questions. And he runs through Midian. And in Midian he sees seven daughters. And they're being harassed by these shepherds. Now ask yourself, what's motivating Moshe? If the only thing that's motivating Moshe is foreigners beating up on Hebrews, so why did he get involved in the second dispute? Maybe because it's still his brothers, so he's interested in his brothers. But now, there are people who aren't his brothers. There's these Midianite girls who are getting harassed by shepherds. And Moshe's still interested in their fate. There's an aggressor and there's a victim. And Moshe says, no, as a human being, I am interested in helping a victim that's being oppressed by an aggressor, right? Just as a person, as an ish. And he saves them. But Tavono al Ruel, so they come to their father. And Yitro says, oh, how come you came back so fast today? What about those shepherds? And the girls say, oh, ish mitzri, hitzilanu mi'adaroim. An Egyptian man saved us from them. How ironic is that? This is the identity he's been running away from, right? Then all of a sudden he looks like an Egyptian man, this Egyptian guy, he saved us. Listen to what Yitro says. V'ayo, so where is this guy? Lama ze azavtem et ha'ish? Why'd you leave the ish behind? What word does he not use to characterize Moshe? Mitzri. You see what's happening? And it's like you're Moshe, and you think of that, oh, this is my kind of guy, right? I'm just an ish. And listen to what Moshe says. Vayoel Moshe. So Moshe was only too content, lashevet et ha'ish, to hang out with that ish, right? An ish, a man after my own heart. Yitro, the man from nowhere, with no identifications, with no horse in this race between the Egyptians and the Jews. And I've had it with this Jewish thing and this Egyptian thing. Just give me somewhere where I can just be a good human being, taking care of other human beings in Midian, and I'm happy. Vatelet Bain, and he gives birth to a child, and he marries Zipporah, and gives birth to a child. But listen to what he says. He calls the child Gershom. A contraction of Ger Sham. Ki amar Ger Hayiti be'eretz Nachria. Because he said, I've been a stranger. I'm a stranger in a strange land. But there's a problem about that. Because Ger Hayiti be'eretz Nachria, right? And Ger Sham, Ger Hayiti be'eretz Nachria reminds you of words earlier in the Torah. Where else did you have, I've been a stranger in a strange land? It's actually God to Avram at the Brit Ben Abtarim, the first time Egyptian slavery was mentioned. Ger yeh zaracha be'eretz lo lahem, your children will be strangers in a strange land, which sets up the irony here. Egyptian slavery is about us, Jews, being strangers in Egypt, which is a strange land because we belong in Israel. So you see the problem, you see the obstacle here? What happens when the only person who can save you has decided that he's a ger in a strange land because he's in Midian and he feels all lonely because where's home for him? Back in Egypt. What if he thinks Egypt is home? And what if he thinks he's a stranger in a strange land? What if his people is estranged because they're in Egypt? But he thinks he's estranged because he's in Midian and he's not in Egypt. What if Egypt is home to him? That's the problem. And here comes God, and then all of a sudden, the king of Egypt dies. And the next person I go up with is my brother. What do I do then? And then God says, you know, you have to save these people. They're your brothers. You have to go back. You have to go back to Egypt and destroy Egypt if necessary. You have to wreak havoc on Egypt and go up against your own brother. How do you get the strength to do that? So that you have Aram. Okay, that's part two. The final thing I want to show you is the chiasm, which is on your source sheets, which will help you see, I believe, the Torah's answer to the story of the climax of the Moshe origin story, which is the meaning of the story of Moshe and Zipporah at the end. Okay. Here's the way this chiasm looks. You'll see there's four colors. There is a, at the top, right? There is a sort of reddish color, red, yellow, green, blue. And on the bottom, blue, green, yellow, red, right? You got that? Because it's a mirror image. Okay, but those are just the generalities. What you're about to see is that at a granular level, everything that happens within each section corresponds to what happens in the earlier section. For example, in the red section, you're actually going to see six elements in the red section, one after another, that are going to correspond to six elements in the other red section. Okay? And this is going to become important, as you'll see, for understanding the Moshe and Tzipora at the end story, because it's one of those pairs. Let me show it to you. I'll also put it up on the screen for you over here, so you can follow along either on the screen or you can follow along in your source sheets. And I'm going to start marking up the screen to show you the particularities of the connections between these. Okay? So let's start in our blue section after the burning bush, the epilogue, right? So look at where it says burning bush, right under that, the blue section. Let's start from Vayelech Moshe Vayeshev al Yeser Chosno, right? Moshe goes, and let's just turn this orange, okay? So Moshe goes, and he returns to Yitro. So now go to the blue section on top of the burning bush, and go to the first element there. And I just want to show you how this sort of perfectly parallels the first element. It's the mirror image of the first element of the blue at the top. And that's pretty easy to see, because what happened at the blue at the top? Moshe is doing what? He's shepherding the sheep of Yitro, and he leads those sheep through the desert until they get to the mountain of God at Horeb. That's the top blue. But if you look at the bottom blue, what happens? Moshe's at Horeb, at the mountain of God. Vayelech Moshe, and he leaves Horeb. Vayashav al Yeser Yisro Chosno, and he goes back to Yitro. So you see how that's a perfect mirror image? Not very difficult, right? Leaving Yitro, going back to Yitro. I leave Yitro, I go to the mountain of God at the top. I leave the mountain of God, I go back to Yitro at the bottom. It's a perfect mirror image. You with me? Easy. Okay. Now let's look at the next element in the blue, the second parallel in the blue. Vayomer lo elcha na v'ashuva el achai. Hold on for one second. Vayomer lo elcha na v'ashuva el achai. So just look over here at that vayomer lo elcha na. Let's turn that yellow. And I want you to look at the blue section, and right after that orange up there on the top of the screen, can you find anything that reminds you of Vayomer lo Elchana? What reminds you of Vayomer lo Elchana somewhere over here after the orange? Ah, isn't that interesting? Right over here, Vayomer Moshe, and Moshe says, instead of Elchana, Asurana. You see that? Let's turn that yellow. And I want to show you, by the way, again, how these are mirror images of each other. Because let's understand what Elchana means, just visually. Here I am, I'm going to say Elchana. Elchana, let me go. What would let me go mean? Go would be this, right? I'm going to walk, right? And I'm going to jump. So that would be Elchana. What would Asurana mean? Asurana means let me turn and see. It means I'm not going anywhere. I'm just going to turn and see. You see how that's the mirror image of Elchana? Elchana is let me proceed horizontally, going in a straight line. The mirror image of that is let me stay where I'm here and not go in a straight line and turn that way and see. But it's the same sort of language. Vayomer Elchana, Vayomer Asurana. Okay. Now I want to show you the explanatory power of the chiasm, right? I talked to you about how the Torah can comment on itself. Here's how you really see the Torah commenting on itself. Because let's talk about what Moshe sees. Vayomer Moshe asura na ve'ereh et amareh hagadol hazeh, madua lo yivar hasneh. I want to see what is going on here. And let's turn this sort of reddish. I want to see this great sight. How come that bush isn't burning? Now what you're about to see here is the chiastic pair that is the pair to the burning bush. Why is that such a big deal? Because you're about to get an explanation of the meaning of the burning bush. Let me ask you, why a burning bush? It's not even such a good miracle if you think about it, right? How long does David have to stand by the side of Route 4 near Queen Anne Road looking at that dumpster on fire before he notices, hey, Karen, that garbage, it's on fire, but I don't think it's burning, right? That's like a good 20 minutes of standing and observing that garbage. It's like, doesn't look like it's burning. It's like not such a good miracle. Like most people would pass that over. It's like how many cars are stopping on Route 4? Everyone's whizzing past. It's only David who stops and he's looking because he's got this scientific mind. He wants to see what's going on. You know what I mean? It's not even such a good miracle. You want to really get someone's attention? Have four elephants flying above a rock. Then he would have stopped. How come he didn't use four elephants flying above a rock? Must be that wasn't the message I wanted to give. There was a message in that burning bush. A message that was so important, I was even willing to use a lousy miracle to express it. Because the message matters. What's the message? What do you think the message is? Why a burning bush? It's a mushel. It's, right? What's the nimshel? What's it about? What's the bush? What's the fire? What's the flames? What is it that God is seeing? Excellent. So who is the bush then? Under that interpretation is the Chizkuni's interpretation, which is the bush would be us, right? The Hebrews. We are on fire. What's the fire? The fire is slavery, right? What does that mean? What that means is that normally what happens to bushes when they're on fire? They burn up. Which means, normally, what happens to nations when they're subjected to slavery for 400 years with their boys thrown in the Nile? They disappear. They get destroyed into ash. In other words, Israel is confronting a civilization-ending event. That's what this is. But the civilization is not ending. Why isn't it ending? Why isn't it ending? Why are they still alive, these Jews? That itself is a miracle. What's the answer? Why are they still alive? The answer is, God had promised long ago that they would still be alive. Ger yezaracha beretz lo lahem, v'avadum v'inu otam, arba me'ot shana. Your children will be enslaved for 400 long years, and I will not let them go. I won't let them be destroyed. I will come after that and save them. They'll be the bush that's burning and not destroyed. Now, here's the thing. Isn't it interesting? Isn't it fascinating that if we go back to Sfarah, you'll see this, that when God decides to save the people, and this is a very important but subtle point, when God decides to save the people, he decides to save them not just because he's empathetic for them. Where is that language over here? Here it is. Not just because he's empathetic. Where is it? It's over. It's down farther. Here. Not just because Vayishma Elokim et Nakatam, not just because God heard their cries, not just because he saw their pain, but Vayizkor Elokim et Brito, he remembered his covenant. What if I took offense to that? What if I said, God, they were suffering so much, why didn't you just save them because they were suffering so much? What does this have to do with the covenant? You know what it has to do with the covenant? This is what it has to do with the covenant. Imagine I'm a ministering angel arguing against God right before the Exodus. And here's what I say. God, I see you're so moved by this people. I see that you want to save them. You know what? I have an argument to make before you go and do it. What are you doing, God? You're going to come out with signs and wonders in 10 plagues and you're going to save them? Are you crazy? You can't do this. You have a world to run. It's called Teva. It's called the laws of physics, okay? Like E equals MC squared, quantum mechanics, right? Newtonian mechanics, all that stuff. The stuff that makes the world go. You pledge to it, right? Like that's the way the world was. You can't go running around making miracles every time some Tom, Dick, and Harry comes and oppresses some other people. You know, when Greece goes and fights the Persians, what are you going to do? You think Greece is in the right and the Persians in the wrong? You're going to make miracles for them too? Then you can't count on anything around here. You're not going to have a world left. I know you feel really bad. You've got to let it go, God. You've got to let it go. I'm telling you, you just got to let it go. What are you going to say if you're God? Right? What are you going to say? What you got to say is, I have a covenant here. And what does the covenant say? What's your argument to me, ministering angel, that I shouldn't get involved with the miracles? I'm already involved. You know why I'm already involved? Because I promised them that they wouldn't be destroyed. Look at those flames. The flames are the cries. Fatal Shavatam, the flames are going up to heaven, like the cries are going up to heaven. Who's responsible for that? You know what the nice thing about being Greece or Rome and not having a covenant? When you face a civilization-ending event, how long does it take? It's over in a year or two, you know what I mean? It's over. You don't suffer. But what happens? Like, it's a weird thing. What if I told you now that right here, in my little bag of tricks, I actually have this little case, and it doesn't hold iPods or ear pods or whatever this is. Actually, I've got some little pills in here. They're immortality pills. I actually have three of them. And if anyone would like, they could just swallow one of these pills. I guarantee you right now, and Dan here, who's a surgeon, will testify to this, that these are medically certified to actually never allow you to die. You will actually be immortal. You can have immortality right now. And the first three people that would like, I'll be happy to hand them one of these pills. Would anyone like one of my three pills, one of my immortality pills? No? No one wants my immortality pill? Seriously, this is really an immortality pill. Free, right? No strings attached. Would anyone like an, you'd all like an immortality pill, right? Here's the downside. The only thing the pill will do for you is make you never die. It won't save you from anything else. It won't save you from cancer. It won't save you from Alzheimer's. It won't save you from any of the ills of old age. It's just you'll never die. Now do you want the pill? Not many of us would take the pill. The promise of immortality to a nation is a double-edged sword. God needs us around. But God's involved, you know what I mean? God needs us around. And once you're around, then God says, I'm already involved. The fact that they're suffering this way is because of me. For 400 years, they're burning and they're not being consumed. I have to save them. The signs and miracles is what I have to do after I already made the promise. I'm already involved. I'm involved because they're not being destroyed. The burning bush seems to be the people are burning, but they're not being destroyed. The chiasm teaches you that that's true. Take a look at the other side of the chiasm. Take a look after the orange, after the yellow, look at the red. After the burning bush, Moshe goes, he returns to Yitro. He says, El Chana, I want to return. What do I want to see? Ashuva El Achai, Asheber Mitzrayim. I want to go and look back at my brothers. Va'ere Ha'odam Chayim. And I want to see, are they really still alive? If you think about that, are they really still alive? Let me just put it in that same color for you. Right? It's the opposite of, right, the question on the other side. Madua lo yivarasne, how come that bush isn't burning? How come that bush isn't burning is, I can't believe it doesn't make sense. It's impossible that that bush should burn and burn. What's the flip side of that? If that's the mushel, what's the nimshel? It's impossible that the people should still be alive. Look at what they're going through. They're going through all of this thing. Ha'odam chayim. Could they still possibly be alive? It's impossible. But in fact, they are still alive. By the way, let me show you something really kind of interesting over here. You see this expression of wonder that Moshe has? Madua lo yivar hasne. How do you spell madua? Mem, dalad, vav, ayin. Now look at the other side. Va'era ha'odam chayim. How do you spell odam? Ayin, vav, dalet, mem. Mem, dalet, vav, ayin. Backwards. It's the mirror image of madua. And it really is the mirror image of madua. Madua is, I'm trying to uproot this. How could it possibly be? Odam is, I don't know. It just is. They're still alive. I can't even understand it. They're still alive. If you stick around afterwards, I'll show you one other Madua and Odam pair in Tanakh, but I don't have enough time to get into it now. But if you're interested, there's one more time this pair of words appears, and it's in the Megillah. We can talk about it afterwards if you like. But let's continue. So the next thing that happens, top of the chiasm, right, is, or actually bottom of the chiasm, is Vayomer Yitro Lemoshe Lech L'Shalom. So Yitro says to Moshe, okay, fine. You can go home if you want. That's perfectly fine. Let's turn this. Whoa, sorry about that. Let's go back and turn this into pink. And we got pink over here. I'll make it pink. Vayomer Yitro Lemoshe Lech L'Shalom. Now, if you say Lech L'Shalom, let's make that pink. What does Lech L'Shalom mean? Why does Lech L'Shalom mean? You can go in peace because it's not dangerous, right? No problem. Just go in peace. What would you say the opposite of go is, right? Go, what does go mean? Go is you're here, and where are you going to go? There. I start here, I'm going to go there. What's the opposite of go then? When you start there, and you come here. Now, the opposite of yes, go, would be no, come. Right? Look at the other side of the chiasm. So God shows up to Moshe and says, Al tikrav halom. Right? Opposite of Al tikrav. You see what Al tikrav is? Whoops, sorry about that. Let's turn that pink. Al tikrav. Do you understand? Al tikrav. Do not come from there to here. Opposite of yes, go from here to there. Now, what's the opposite of Lech L'Shalom? Lech L'Shalom, Yitro said, is go in peace because it's fine. It's not dangerous. The opposite of it's not dangerous is? It is dangerous, which is exactly what God says to Moshe at the burning bush. Al tikrav alom, don't come close. Why? Because it's really dangerous. You could die if you come close. Instead, you got to take off your shoes. Oh, you have to take off your shoes. Why? Remember what Yitro says? Don't worry, no problem. Lech l'shalom. How many syllables in shalom? Two. Shalom. Right? Shalom. Look at the top of the chiasm. Do you see the shal and lom? Al tikrav ha lom. Shal. Na'alecha ma'araglecha. Don't come too close. Take off your shoes. Right? Perfect mirror images. Okay, let's go to the green. I'm just going to try to go through this quickly. It won't get to necessarily all the elements, right? But Vayhi Bayomer Rav Mahem, Vayamat Melech Mitzrayim, right? Over here, the king of Egypt dies at the top of the chiasm. Let's put that in green. Here we go. Can you find the pair to that at the bottom of the chiasm in the green? Vayomer Hashem al Moshe b'Midyan. God says to Moshe, go back to Mitzrayim, ki meitu kol anashim v'vakshim et nafshecha. Because all the people who have sought to kill you are dead. Who are the people who sought to kill Moshe? Paro. Do you get it? It's the same thing. Right? Two ways of talking about the death of Pharaoh. The people who are going to try to kill you, i.e. Pharaoh, pairs up with Vayamat Melech Mitzrayim. Pharaoh dies. Okay? Now let's go into the yellow. Let's look at the yellow down here. The yellow down here, we've got Vayikach Moshe et Ishto vet Banov. Moshe takes his... Moshe takes his wife and his children. Let's turn that blue. Can anyone find a pair to Moshe taking his wife and children, right, in the beginning of yellow at the top of the chiasm? Moshe taking wife and children. Oh, when does Moshe originally take a wife? I.e., when does he marry her? Right over here in the beginning of yellow. Vayiten et tzipito tzipor l'moshe l'pito. And immediately afterwards, vateled bein. You see what's happening? The taking of wife and the arrival of child, right, mirrors the taking of wife and child later. Okay? Let's continue. There's more, but just for the sake of time, let me now take you into the red. And the red is where we're going to get to the story at the hotel. Right? So, here we are in red. Very quickly, let's go to red at the bottom. Vamarta al Paro, Moses, this is what you say to Pharaoh, Ko Amar Hashem, thus says God, B'ni B'chori Yisrael, Ko. And I lost my cursor over here. Ko Amar Hashem, can you find a Ko in the top red, anyone? Can you find a ko in the top red? Vayifen kova ko. Okay? So why that matches up, we'll leave for another time, but it does. And the vayifen kova ko is the pair here. Okay, let's continue. After that, we have a verbal death threat. God says, here's what I'm telling you to do, Moshe. Let's turn this red. Va'omar elecha, I'm commanding you to tell Pharaoh. Shalach et b'ni vayavdeni, send out my child. And if you dare to not send out my child Israel, hine anochi horeg es bincha b'chorecha, I will kill your firstborn child. The issuance of a verbal death threat. Can you find the issuance of a verbal death threat in the top red after that little blue, vayifen ko vako? Right? Here it is right over here. Vayomer, he says, I'm sorry, what color was I up to? I was up to, no, I was up to red. Here we go. Sorry about that. You get the idea. Vayomer, misam chali yisar fu shofet alenu, halahargeni ata omer, this is it. Halahargeni ata omer, are you threatening me? Right? Are you threatening me with death? Look how close it is, by the way. Halahargeni ata omer at the bottom, and va'omar elecha, hine anochi horeg. God says, I will kill all Egyptian firstborn, parallels to halahargeni ata omer. Are you going to kill me? Now, you're about to see something really interesting going into our final climactic moment of understanding what happened at the end. Strangely, the verbal death threat that Moshe is now telling, that God is now telling Moshe to issue to Pharaoh, which is, if you don't let the Jews go, I'm going to kill your firstborn. The parallel to that in the chiasm is the death threat that the aggressor is accusing Moshe of implicitly issuing towards him by saying, are you going to kill me like you killed the Egyptian? Strange. What do we make of it? Next thing that we find is Vayhi baderach b'malon vayifkesheyu Hashem vayivakesh hamito. And that night at the hotel, God came to kill Moshe. A king comes to kill and seeks to kill someone. Does a king coming and seeking to kill someone, does that happen? And that happens in the red after the blue, red, and we're up to purple. And now blue, red, and purple. Is there another king that seeks to kill Moshe after the red up top? Oh, isn't that interesting? There is, isn't there? Vayishma paro tadavar azeh. Paro hears this. Vayivakesh laharog et Moshe. By the way, exactly the same words, right? There's that word, vayivakesh. And he seeks to kill him, just like God, who at the end seeks to kill Moshe. There's a heavenly king that seeks to kill Moshe. The mirror of that is an earthly king that seeks to kill Moshe. By the way, how did I find this? I found this because this is actually the first thing that I saw. The first thing I saw was, oh my gosh, I can't believe it. When God seeks to kill Moshe, that language mirrors the language that Pharaoh uses when he seeks to kill Moshe. But I didn't really think anything of it until I started noticing these other parallels. Now I noticed, one second, those two things aren't just parallel because two kings are seeking to kill Moshe with exactly the same words. There's this whole elaborate chiasm, and they're exactly at the right place. They're exact pairs in this chiasm. The Torah is telling you, if you want to understand why God wanted to kill Moshe at the end, the answer lies in why Paro wanted to kill Moshe back in Mitzrayim. If you can figure out why Paro wanted to kill Moshe, you'll understand why God wanted to kill him too. What does that mean? Why did Paro want to kill Moshe? Let's go back to our reason. We suggested it might not be because of thing one. It could be because of thing two. I.e., it could be because of the verbal death threat. Do you remember that? In other words, put yourself in Pharaoh's shoes. Who is Pharaoh? What interest does he have in Moses interceding in a fight between two Hebrews? The interest is, I am king. I run the court system around here. I can't have somebody doing vigilante justice. I can't have you putting on your star and your sheriff. You have no standing. If you want to get involved when a foreigner attacks your brother, I get it. But if you want to get involved because you just think you're the court system, you're not the court system. You can't just put on a star and be the sheriff. Who are you? You have no standing. Pharaoh, in essence, would side with the aggressor when the aggressor says, okay, what does this mean? What emerges from this algebra is something absolutely crazy, but I'm just going to say it because it seems to be what the Torah is saying. What emerges from this is, here's why God wants to kill Moshe. Paro wanted to kill Moshe because Moshe is issuing an illegitimate death threat, which means God wants to kill Moshe because Moshe is also issuing an illegitimate death threat. What death threat? The death threat that God told him to issue. The death threat against Pharaoh, that if you don't let the Jews go, I'm going to kill your firstborn. What's the problem with this and why is it so crazy? God told him to do it. How could the same God who told Moshe to issue that death threat want to kill Moshe for issuing that death threat? Ah, here's where it all comes together. For some reason, that's true. The same God who wanted Moshe to issue that death threat is now going to kill Moshe for issuing that death threat. Because there's something illegitimate about it. And it goes back to Moshe's identity crisis. Why was it so important for God to resolve the identity crisis? With Aaron, with something, to somehow pull Moshe in. It was important because of this. Remember, the only thing that makes God act is not just empathy in this situation. There's one thing else. Because God's going to have empathy towards Greece, and Rome also. What else? It's Greek. It's the covenant. What's missing over here? Greek. He hasn't gotten around to circumcising his child. That's going to kill him. Why hasn't he gotten around to circumcising his child? Because when you do that irrevocable act, what are you saying? I am a Jew. The identity crisis is over. But what if it's not over? Was it coincidence that, there's a lot going on, the whole burning bush thing, didn't get around to circumcising my kid? Yeah? Or was there a reason that that just kind of dropped off? Right? And Tzipora gets it and says, no, we've got to circumcise our kid. What's going on? I close with the following analogy. Yamim Noraim comes around, and we say two words about God over and over again on Yom Kippur. Avinu Malkeinu. And we never even bother thinking what an incredible thing we're saying when we say that. Because at face value, those two words are utterly contradictory. They're two entirely different relationships. What is the hallmark of a king? How does a king relate to his subjects? Completely objectively, I judge you. You are my subjects. I'm not partial. I'm the judge and I'm the jury. And that's how I deal with you. And the din is the way it all goes. And that's the way life goes. And that's what it means to be a judge. And that's what it means to be a king. And God is our king. But a father? Compassion. A father, ultimate bias, right? I'm on your side. I'm never going to let you go. What's the one guarantee that a father would give a kid if he only could? I'll never let you be destroyed. Imagine a kid, the father, by the way, with ultimate power. Imagine your God. How would you raise your kids, right? You got ultimate power, ultimate political power, all the money in the world. Would you spoil them? Would you never let them work a day in their lives? No, because you'd think it's good for them to work. But your kid's going to get resentful. How come dad is not on my side? So you know what you do? You'd make the following deal with your kid. You'd say, look, you got to live your own life. Can't take that away from you. You're going to have to scratch. You're going to have to work. The one thing I'm going to tell you is this. Make your own mistakes. The one guarantee I will give you is that if you ever get yourself in a hole where you face a civilization-ending event, where it's all going to be over for you, that's where I'll use my power. I will not let you be destroyed. That's my guarantee. Which is God's guarantee? When God says, I'm not just your king, I'm your father, I have a grit with you, your family, I am ensuring that you'll always be here, that's the grit. The question is, does Moshe buy into that? That's what he's been prevaricating about. Whose brother am I? I just don't know. I'd rather just be an Ish. I'd rather not be bothered. Along comes Aaron, but I haven't quite met Aaron yet. And God pushes me and says, go. Isn't it that I haven't quite circumcised my son? What's the issue? The great moment in the Torah where father and king, or where these two roles collide, is actually in the laws of Goel Adam. For those of you who learned Gemara, you know these laws, but basically it goes like this. Imagine there is an inadvertent murderer. There's a person who's negligent. Somebody's chopping wood in the forest. He's not careful with his axe. And he commits involuntary manslaughter in the third degree. And it's bad. Not first degree murder, but it's bad. He really wasn't careful and he killed somebody. Now, what's the law? What do you do with a guy like that? Do you kill him? Is he liable to capital punishment? No, because it's not premeditated murder. That's how the king sees it. But that's not how the family sees it. How does the family see it? If you're the brother of the victim, how do you see it?
Revenge.
What, are you going to let him off? He wasn't careful with his axe. He killed my brother because he wasn't careful with his axe. He saw him and he just wasn't careful. He saw him and he wasn't careful. For you, there's no distinction between that and premeditated murder. I'm coming after him. The Torah, interestingly, creates this bifurcation between the state and the family in that situation. And it says, looked at it as king, this guy does not deserve to die. But there is some validity to the family's perspective, but only if you're family. What does that mean? There is someone called a Goel Adam. A Goel Adam is somebody who's family, who has the right to come after the inadvertent killer and to try to kill him. But how's the state going to relate to that? The state's going to recognize that right, but the state as state says, we don't think he deserves to die. We have to protect him. We're going to create cities of refuge to protect him. You see that balance between the state and family. Yeah, the family can come after him, but we, the state, have to protect him. So we're going to create cities of refuge. Okay. So imagine there's a city of refuge. So here's Bob, the inadvertent murderer. He was negligent with his axe, right? And he killed Phil's brother. Phil is coming after Bob. And David is sitting by his, he's sitting out there eating lunch on Fifth Avenue. And all of a sudden he looks up from lunch to this park bench and he sees Bob, the inadvertent murderer, huffing and puffing, running and trying to get to the city of refuge. And then he sees Phil running after him with a dagger trying to kill him. And he immediately figures out, oh, I get it, inadvertent murderer. There's a Goel Adam. That's Phil. Well, David is licensed to carry. He's got his AK-47. Pulls out his AK-47, and he sees Bob and says, Phil, I'll do you a favor, right? Because you never can catch up to Bob. He's faster than you. Takes out his AK-47 and kills Bob. Oh, no, he wasn't allowed to do that. What would the court do? The court in that situation would say that the interloper is the murderer. But what if David said in defense, but what's the difference if I kill him or if Bob kills him? If Phil kills him, the answer is no. Phil is family. Then, as family, yes, you're right. But if you're not family, misam chalish sarva shofei daleinu. Who made you the sheriff around here? You have no standing. You can't just do vigilante justice. Only the family could do that. Here comes God, the king. And for many, many years, God is king. The king over all of humanity. And then he makes a bridge with one nation. And all of a sudden, he says, I'm never letting you die. You guys are like family to me. And then God says to Moshe, this whole long thing, and at the end of it all, says, I just have to tell you what you have to say to Pharaoh. You tell Pharaoh, to me, Bechori Yisrael, my firstborn child is Israel. Send out my child. And if you don't send out my child, that's my English I'll tell Pharaoh, if you dare to keep my child kidnapped, I'm coming after your firstborn child. Now, when God says that, is he acting as king or is he acting as family? That was family. B'ni b'chor Yisrael, my child is Israel. I'm coming after you. In other words, as king, the ministering angels would say, but that's a miscarriage of justice. You can't just come along and like make the 10th plague and kill everybody. All these millions of kids, they're all going to die. What, because you decide that you're Mr. Vigilante? God says, yeah, the family. This is what I'm doing for my kid. Right? It's Mel Gibson and Ransom. You know what I mean? I'm coming after you. Right? And I don't care what it takes. I'm coming after you. This is God as parent. God as Goel Adam. This has nothing to do with justice. This has to do with family. This is what I'm doing because I'm father. And therefore, Moshe, the one thing in your dark night of the soul that you have to get out of this burning bush experience is you have to come out of there and decide who your family is. I'm going to give you Aaron. And if you love Aaron, right, maybe that'll be it. And he comes out of that. And for the first time, he says, Ashuba Achai, I want to go back to my brothers back in Egypt. He treats them as brothers, but he's still not quite sure. He hasn't circumcised his child. So along comes Tzipporah. And Tzipporah, the girl who once called him an Ishmitzri, who once called him Egyptian, takes a flint, circumcises her child, and she's the one who makes the decision, who puts the issue to rest, and says, we're a Jewish family. This identity crisis is over. I'm making an irrevocable mark on this child to make an irrevocable commitment that says, we are Jews. And from there's no looking back, right? And Moshe becomes part of the people for the first time. And from there, he becomes Moshe Rabbeinu. Because of her, he's able to become Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe's the hero. But the women in the story are the heroes too. You know, it's like, if I don't know if you guys are Lord of the Rings people, right? But, you know, Frodo takes the ring all the way to Mount Doom, but can't quite cast the ring in, right? But he's still the hero because he took him there. And Moshe takes himself all the way there, somehow can't make that final decision, but his wife is able to make that decision for them. And together, they become Jews, right? And Moshe becomes Moshe Rabbeinu. That is the climax and the end of the Moshe origin story. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.